And it's my pleasure to welcome Andre DeShields to the big table tonight. Mr. DeShields, thanks for being here.
Good evening, Chicago. Now, before we start rolling.
All right, what'd I do?
Can I do wrong? Something?
Yeah.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Justin Kaufman. Happy birthday to you. Wow.
Yeah. How about that?
Wow, sounds good.
That was from the download a couple of years ago on my birthday. Andre DeShields was in for an interview, and then he sang spontaneously to me. And now he's up for a Tony Award.
Probably because he did sing
that's
spontaneously.
Right. You know what? I'm just saying there's a method to the madness. For some of our great theater actors. Chris Jones is here. He is the chief theater critic for the Chicago Tribune, has been for years.
Yeah.
He's also the author of Rise Up, Broadway and American Society, From Angels in America to Hamilton. He's also here to talk about the Tony nomination which came out today. Great to see you, man.
Nice to see you.
Way
too long. Great to be back on the air with you.
All right, so first let's get into the nitty-gritty of today's news, which is the Tony nominations. Any surprises for you?
Well, I would say there were two big snubs. Number one, Glenda Jackson. Who played King Lear, and Glenda Jackson, you know, a great, one of the, you know, greatest actors of her generation, octogenarian, kind of a eminence grise, as they say, and for her to not get anything was a bit of a surprise. Mm. The show she's in, King Lear, is not great. I would have given her a nomination. It's kind of a flawless performance, you know, she doesn't miss a line, you know, God help us all. Being able to do that at her age, and she's incredible in it. So I found that weird. And then the great Nathan Lane, who's in a truly bizarre show called Gary, very strange show, a sequel to Titus Andronicus, but it's really a kind of absurdist play. It's really a meditation on the difference. Let me ask you this question. Do you know the difference between, how would you describe the difference between a clown and a fool?
Makeup.
That's good.
Yeah, you're right.
Okay, so the posh answer to that question is that a clown makes people laugh. A fool, however, speaks truth to power. So you were more of a fool than a clown, no question.
Thank you.
So that's what the play's really about. And if that floats your boat, you'll like Gary. But Nathan Lane, this great American comedian, does a really great performance in it. And I think that's an egregious omission too.
Overall, when you look at all, before we get into Chicago connections, overall, is this a good year for Broadway? Are there good shows? Are the shows that were nominated? Because when I look at it, I hadn't paid much attention to Broadway this season. And looking at it, you see these kind of Tootsie type shows where they're kind of or the show about the Temptations, where it seems like
proud,
it doesn't seem like it's very creative. But you're saying it's a good season.
Well, I think we're in a funny time, as we all know, and I think what you're seeing on Broadway is a sort of a tension between, let's call it, the old school traditional show. And the hipster, Brooklyn-loving, new musical for the young and the woke.
Right, that's me.
The young and the woke.
Right, right.
And so you can see in all the categories, really, you can see these sort of conflicts. So if you take, for example, in the best musical, the two best shows of the year, in my opinion, were a show called Hadestown, which is a really cool score, with starring the fabulous Andre DeShields, who just serenaded you there.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, the epitome of cool in the show. And it's a sort of a very rootsy, very, you know, they sing about building a wall. It's very political. It sounds really spectacular. It's a really beautiful show. It's sort of Westworld meets True Blood meets you know, kind of folk music. It's a really, really cool show. Will Mr. and Mrs. America from Des Moines, who go to Broadway, like Hadestown? I don't know. Probably not. But that's that. And then the second show is this show, Tootsie, which, of course, is based on the movie. We had it here in the tryout in Chicago, as you know. And it's an old school. It's an old school show. It's a guy dresses as a woman to get some work.
People know the story.
I don't know that anybody under 50 really remembers that film, which might come as a shock to anybody over 50. But nonetheless, I think that's the fact of it. But it's a very traditional show. It's very good. It has a great, funny book. It has a traditional jazzy score by David Yazbek. It's exactly what you would think of as a musical comedy. So only one of those two can win, and that's that. Now, you look in the best revival category, and you've got the same thing. You've got Kiss Me, Kate, a revival of Kiss Me, Kate, Scott Ellis directed, perfectly fine, traditional. Kiss mm-hmm, me gay, mm-hmm. kiss me gay. And then you have this bizarre Daniel Fish Oklahoma that like rips Oklahoma apart,
yeah, right.
like stuffs it back together. There's like a sex scene with Judd Fry. There's a half of the show is in a blackout. They there's no belief in love. Laurie is kind of mad the whole time. The Dream Ballet has one dancer, one, and a contemporary sort of guys. The whole thing is like eye-popping, what the heck Oklahoma am I just walked into? And again, if you are young and woke, that is your Oklahoma. That is your show. If you want the traditional thing, you got Kiss Me, K.
Right.
So you can see the same sort of conflict.
Every generation has to have their own Oklahoma.
It
yeah, that just that's
it
way
does.
That's
it
right.
does.
That's right. Well, let's get to the Chicago connections, because yeah. you mentioned Andre DeShields, and we heard him serenading. Just he was on the show a couple years back. But that's what I was saying earlier. I only want the people who are on any of the WGN shows to win when it comes to the Tonys. But the let's talk about the Chicago connections, because the first, Laurie Metcalf is on the verge of history. I was reading just this idea that she's won, what, 2 years in a row now. This would
be
a third.
I think it's actually four. I believe she has been nominated for a Tony.
Unbelievable.
4 years in a row. So basically, a morning in the Laurie Metcalf household goes like this. It's like, oh, it's Tony nomination day. You're going to get one. Come on. You know, don't pull all that stuff. You know you're going to get one. You got one for the last 4 years. So, I mean, it's just sort of incredible. And she's got, Laurie Metcalf is one of these things that we, these phenomena that we thought we had to ourselves in Chicago. And in fact, we did. I mean, people knew her from Roseanne and they knew her from TV, right, but people really didn't know outside of Chicago all about her stage work. And then suddenly, over the last 4 years, she's blown up on Broadway. And so people now, and I think with good foundation, describe her as kind of the first lady of the American stage.
That's
our
amazing.
Laurie Metcalf.
Yeah, right. Steppenwolf, right.
Yeah. I mean, and frankly, she's not, you know, showing up at Steppenwolf all that often anymore. So
that tends to happen.
Yeah,
when you become the first lady of American
it
theater.
Does. The paychecks
yeah,
are a
right,
little different.
Right.
So she's really a phenomenon, and I that is kind of an amazing thing. So there's certainly, she's a major, major triumph. She plays Hillary Clinton in this play, Hillary and Clinton, which actually was done in Chicago, but not nowhere near as well as they're doing it on Broadway. And it's a hard play to describe. It's basically, Laurie plays Hillary. They're in a hotel room in New Hampshire, and the question of the play is, does she need Bill? Bill, played by John Lithgow, eventually shows up anyway, because that's what Bill Clinton did.
Bill
and then
does,
he goes out, he gives a speech in the play, and he basically does her some good. So a lot of the play is this sort of existential angst over, you know, does Bill hurt me or harm me? Which, as we all know, is right. a fundamental question about the Clinton legacy. And it's interesting because it's a quirky play, but it kind of gets at what the complexity of the Clintons. And it's sort of, that is what it's about. And she's very good, as is John Lithgow. So, you know, that's actually a pretty good
yeah.
show.
And then you talk about you mentioned Tootsie. Tootsie
yeah.
has Chicago connections because of the pre-tryout here in Broadway.
Yeah, they improved it from here. Yeah.
Did they?
They did.
And beyond that, you start to get into director. Who else has got Chicago connections?
Well, Scott Ellis, who did Kiss Me, Kate, certainly trained here. He's a pretty important figure. I mean, one Chicagoan that I thought might get a nod and who didn't was Tracy Letts, who's in he's in All My Sons. So that's the Arthur Miller play that a lot of people have seen. Quite a famous play, of course. And Tracy's in it alongside Annette Bening. Both very good. Also Benjamin Walker, who plays Chris, the kid. And, you know, the one-minute version of that show is that Tracy Letts plays Joe Keller. And if you don't know the play, it's basically about this guy who, during the Second World War, sort of sent out crack cylinder heads from his factory and then covered it up. And then the crack cylinder heads went into fighter planes. The young guys went down. And the play is really the revelation of his guilt in doing that. It's a real, you know, classic play written right after the Second World War. And generally speaking, Joe Keller, this main character, is a folksy guy who is trying to cover up his past mistakes. Tracy plays him as this sort of psychopath, you know, hidden psychopath with this kind of, this sense that like, oh, this is a bad guy. This is a really bad guy. And it's a very different way of approaching the role, but I think it sort of works, particularly in a time when we have probably less sympathy mm-hmm. for these guys. And you sort of watch this performance and you go, well, I wonder what else he's done, you know? So that is a kind of a, you know, a sort of fascinating thing as well.
Let's take a break. When we come back, I want to ask you about just Broadway in general, because, you know, as a layman, someone who doesn't pay attention to the new plays or anything that gets staged in this year that would be qualified for Tonys, you know, all I can think about is what's happening from last year's crop or the year before. How long do these plays stay on stage? What's the cycle like? Is it making money? We'll talk about all okay. that. Chris Jones is here. He, of course, is chief theater critic over at the Chicago Tribune and the author of Rise Up, Broadway and American Society from Angels in America to Hamilton. We'll talk more with Chris coming up here on Extended. 720. Stay with us. I won't let you down because you believed in me. And now anybody can see I'm really alive. I won't let you. Extension 720. Chris Jones is here. In a conversation about Broadway and, of course, the Tony nominations that just came up. Chris Jones, of course, chief theater critic over at the Tribune, also the author of Rise Up, Broadway and American Society, from Angels in America to Hamilton. I want to get to the Hamilton exhibit.
Yeah.
But I wonder, you know, from all of the shows, when I look at the Tony nominations, I see all of these shows. And I get embarrassed. I'm like, I didn't even know there were this many shows around Broadway. I don't know how many theaters there are. Because you 45. Automatically thinking that Dear Evan Hansen and the Harry Potter play and maybe the Bruce Springsteen play. I don't know what's still on stage. But those are all still... Yeah. Rocking and rolling. Those are the big ticket. Yeah. How does Broadway sustain all of these shows?
Well, you know, it's a funny business. It really is, because there's a limited number of theaters. Right. So in many, many cases, let's say Justin Kaufman wants to produce a Broadway show, the number one problem you would have is getting a theater. So the people that own these theaters command enormous power. And they're able to basically make these deals. So one of the things that people often don't know is that, let's say your show isn't doing very well, but you're like, oh, we're okay. We can hang on through these rough months. Often you'll get kicked out of the theater because in the contract is a clause saying basically, if you don't make X amount of money, they can kick you out for the next hot show for Bruce Springsteen if they want to. So it's a sort of a funny business because there are these finite number of theaters. And the other thing that happens is when a show is a massive blockbuster, like a Wicked or a Lion King or even a Dear Evan Hansen, they can lock up theaters for 5, 10,
yeah,
some cases 20 years. You know, it's sort of analogous. I had a story this week about the Cirque du Soleil in Las Vegas has announced this new show at Luxor, directed by, or written by rather, Robert Rodriguez, the Spy Kids director, right, and all right, that, right. Yeah. And I was talking to them this week, and they were saying most of the Vegas shows that Cirque does, it's like the Beatles, Love, and the Michael Jackson show, and Mystère, and Oh, probably a lot of people listening to this have seen one of them. They've been there for 25 years. 25 years, people have grown old in those shows. And that's because Vegas always has a new market and new people. And New York, to some degree, is a bit like that. So it's true that some shows just last a long time. Unlike a movie, where you can send it globally around the world in 5 minutes, in the theater, you're limited by the capacity of the theater.
And I would assume that there may be, and this is why I always love the dichotomy of Broadway, because you will have pure creativity.
Yes.
And like you were talking about the revival of Oklahoma and the people that go into that. But at the same time, there has to be this risk aversion in the way that you, if you have a mediocre hit or people don't understand it or maybe it flops, you're out in a heartbeat.
That, I mean, the way that people mitigate that risk is simple. It's celebrity performances.
Yeah.
So if you look, for example, at the show Network, which is on Broadway right now, stars Bryan Cranston, nominated for a Tony Awards. He's excellent. Bryan Cranston and basically said, I'll do this show through June. And then that's it. Thank you very much. Had enough. I'm going to go off, do a movie, whatever. And they're closing. They are closing. And it tells you that without Bryan Cranston, they just don't have a viable show. Or if you look over just down the street from there, there's a revival of a Lanford Wilson play called Burn This, and it stars Adam Driver. Now, I was at Burn This the other night with Adam Driver. No one around me knew what the heck burn this was, right? No one was going to see a Lamford Wilson play. I don't think anybody was even going to see Kerry Russell, frankly. Yeah, right. Everybody was going to see this guy. Mm. And so, in other words, these celebrity performances in these shows, and it was the same with Daniel Radcliffe.
I was going to say, and also I would assume Broadway stars back in the day, if you were Bernadette Peters or you were I don't even know, Gene Kelly, I don't know who it is, but there was this idea that it didn't really matter what they were in, they wanted to go see Bernadette Peters.
Well, I think that's true in musicals, that there are some stars like Kelly O'Hara, who's in Kiss Me, Kate, for example, or Stephanie J. Block, who's in The Cher Show, another show that was here. Now, if you say Stephanie J. Block, anyone listening who follows Broadway musicals will know who that is. Do most people know who she is? No. Right? So there's, but musicals can sort of survive on the brand of the show. So people are going to the Cher Show because it's Cher,
right,
predominantly, right? And how nice that it's Stephanie J. Block. But if you look at plays, you know, to get somebody to go to a play, you really have to deliver at Adam.
You have to have Adam Driver.
Adam Driver or Daniel Radcliffe or
something. That begs the question, when you think about musicals and you think about plays, can a Broadway show sustain itself or just be successful on the Broadway culture accepting it? Meaning, you said the Stephanie Block, people know her if you're into Broadway. Can a show just survive with the people that are into Broadway?
Well, the answer to that's a great question. And the answer to that question, if the show itself becomes a brand. So if I were to say a show like Dear Evan Hansen or Wicked, you probably couldn't tell me, and I actually couldn't tell you, who's in Wicked tonight on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And nor do any of the people going to Wicked tonight on Broadway. They'll be there right now. It'll be coming down any second. And that show is all about the title. So, you know, what you find with these brands, these, like, you know, commercial brands like Disney World, basically, people go for the show and they don't know who's in it. And in fact, the producers are quite happy with that because they don't want to have to do that. But that doesn't work with plays. It just doesn't, because you can't get enough excitement. So you have to have, you know, you have to have a big celebrity, and that causes, you know, that causes excitement. I mean, people really will go to New York to see Bryan Cranston. He has an enormous fan base and he's very good. You know, the thing about celebrities on Broadway is that they vary, frankly. Some of them are actually great actors. I always think it's the celebrities who started out as stage actors and got famous, Bryan Cranston, who actually perfectly good when they go back on the stage, versus the celebrities who, you know, let's say, never really learn how to project, Kerry Russell, who, you know, are maybe less good, you know.
Does Broadway self-edit in that regard? I mean, do you have producers and otherwise that say, that's a great star, that's a big name, but I know this person cannot carry?
I think in some cases that's true, but I think sometimes, you know, all other things being equal, they have to sell tickets. It's a business, and they know very well, you know, that that's what's going to happen. You know, you've also got this phenomenon now of these residencies on Broadway, because Springsteen started that, and you've got Morrissey coming up in I think it starts in like another 2 weeks or thereabouts, doing basically a Broadway show. So that what's gone on there is you've got these sort of mostly aging, or let's say slightly past their prime, musicians, but still obviously a huge
are those musicals, are those Broadway shows?
Well,
or are they just
narrative,
like,
I would describe them as based, I mean, the Springsteen show is phenomenally good. They're narrative concerts. They're a desire on the part of these stars to do a bit more than just a set list of their greatest hits, and to actually create some sort of narrative. And Broadway carries a certain clout, and I think if they can sell tickets, then it's a sort of a thing. Same thing is happening in Vegas, where you've got Lady Gaga, you've got, you know, a variety of other, I think...
Britney Spears has one.
There's Ariana Grande. There's a whole bunch of.
Do you see a future on Broadway of that? I mean, obviously you saw Bruce Springsteen. You're seeing Morrissey, but are you going to see every band from U2 to the Snoop Dogg get a shot at doing a stage show where they know they're going to get bank? I mean, they're going to get their contract, and they're just going to sit on that stage for 6 months.
Well, I think there's a limited number of people who are willing to do that. I mean, the thing is that if you and I produce a Springsteen show, we have to get him to agree to do it for long enough we can make our money back.
And he can't really miss it. It's not like there's an understudy for Bruce Springsteen.
No, he can't miss it. In fact, you have to give people their money back if he misses it.
Right.
So that's another sort of dilemma with it. So then you've got this other phenomenon, like, okay, if you can't get on Broadway, what if you're Cher? So Cher doesn't have to do a damn thing, but every night people go to the theater and worship Cher, and they see three Chers all younger than the real Cher, of course. And they're in, you know, this phenomenon of jukebox musicals. So the new one this season was Ain't Too Proud, which is a look at the Temptations, which is sort of a show did quite well and got some Tony nominations. I thought it was a little weird because there have been so many Temptations over the years. I think there's been over 20.
Mm-hmm.
People who could legitimately say I was a temp.
Yeah, right.
And so it's a little bit of a, like, unlike Jersey Boys, which is like these guys.
Yeah, you're paying attention. Right.
This is like, it's a revolving door. But it's the music is the music, of course. And so, you know, that's the other phenomenon, is that people really want to experience that. I mean, it's interesting. Another show that we had here that did not do well in the Tonys was Pretty Woman. So that it's a perfectly fine show in the sense that, you know, if you walk by the theater where it is in New York, the Niederlander, you see very dressed up people having a big night out, looking great, looking $1 million, ready to re-experience a little bit of sex, a little bit of glamour, you know, a little bit of a retro movie. And I'm like, you know, bring it on. It's not everything is for intellectuals. And it's, you know, it's a big marketplace of shows. And the dilemma they always have is that people don't like to go to things that they don't know what they are. And there's good reason for that, because it's expensive.
Well, that's the reason. Right. I mean, you're talking about... Right. My friend reached out to me. He's like, you got to see the Harry Potter. You got to take your son to see the Harry Potter show. And then we were just on a quick Google search. And you're talking about, I mean, it's a two-parter. And it was $400, $500 a ticket.
Each.
Just like, all right, okay.
It's
right.
A, you know, by the time
I'll
you've
go
done,
see Endgame again.
By the time you've done with dinner... You know, it's $1,000 night in many cases. And it's easy in my job to forget just how much money it costs people. Although I buy Cub tickets, then I remember.
Yeah, Chris Jones is here. He's the chief theater critic at the Chicago Tribune. Also the author of Rise Up, Broadway and American Society, From Angels in America to Hamilton. We'll continue with Chris. We'll talk about the Hamilton exhibit at Northerly Island. We'll also talk about this Hamlet show that you reviewed at the Chicago Humanities Festival. I teed it up earlier. I would totally want to hear about this. Talking theater tonight on Extension 720 with Chris Jones. Good to see you.
Nice to be here.
I've always enjoyed our conversations. I always
likewise.
I appreciate the dedication you have to the beat.
Thank you. It's a lot.
It's a lot. Chief theater critic and, of course, the author of Rise Up, Broadway and American Society, From Angels in America to Hamilton. You going to do more books? Is books?
No, that book was a lot of work. I kind of wanted to do this book about how we got to Hamilton, because I think it's just so fascinating. And it's doing well. They put Hamilton on the cover, so that always helps. That anything helps. With Hamilton on the cover is fine. I'm happy to glob onto that. And it's sort of the story about how Broadway got more ambitious and more political, and it paid off, you know? And so that was kind of my theory. Really.
Hamilton, of course, in the news here in Chicago last week, an exhibit opened up at Northerly Island.
Yeah.
And this is something that is a theatrical experience in a museum exhibit.
So this is a unique phenomenon. So this takes a bit of explaining. It's like, so out here on Northerly Island, you've got a great big aircraft hangar-like building right on the old, you know, notorious runway on Northerly Island. And they've put in it an exhibit really all about Alexander Hamilton, the guy, not Hamilton, the show. But they're using the vocabulary of the show, which is to say Lin-Manuel Miranda's face, the lyrics of the show, the music of the show, to sort of tell that story. And the theory is that Hamilton fans will be drawn to it and drawn to learning more about the guy himself. I don't know of any other Broadway show that's really done that. I mean, there have been sort of exhibits based on, you know, movies, mm-hmm. and there have even mm-hmm. been exhibits based on TV shows. But they're usually sort of the, you know, in the case of something like Downton Abbey, they're like the story behind the story, or how we got all the props or something. This really isn't that. It really is a history exhibit. The weird thing about it, really, is that it's not in a museum. It's because Hamilton likes to do what Hamilton likes to do, and they've just basically gone on their own, and they've built a building. And I think the plan is to be here for about a year. And so some... It's really beautiful. I mean, if you go, and I think you should, I mean, it's a major attraction in our city. Mm-hmm. No one else has seen it. Very few people have seen it, even now. And it's a really classy way to introduce your kids, especially if you've got teenagers. It's a great way to introduce them to American history. It's got all the music in the show in a new symphonic recording. You've got Lin-Manuel and Philippa Sue and Chris Jackson sort of leading you through it. It's really cool. And it gets into complex things like the assumption of state debt, that excitement of that, and also about the war and about the duel between Burr and Hamilton, and it's really very, very cool. Hmm. It's not cheap, so some people have sort of said it's a lot of money. It's about, I think it's $40. Now, that's a lot cheaper than a ticket to Hamilton, obviously.
Yeah.
The last thing in the show, and I guess I'm sort of irritating them by giving this away, but hey, it's public now, so we're going to do it. The last thing in the show is a 3D scene filmed of the first number of Hamilton, starring Lin-Manuel Miranda. It's not the original cast. It's when he went back in to do the thing in Puerto Rico. And you stand in a 3D theater watching essentially the first number, wow, of the show. And it's like you're in the idea, anyway. It wasn't working entirely around the time I saw it, but that was the first day, so I'm sure it's fine now. The idea is that you feel immersed in Hamilton. So on some levels, if you've got some kid at home who's like, oh, take me to Hamilton, you're like, it's $400. You can actually say, we'll go to this instead. And it's only $40, and you have to learn the history.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of the equation. They're hoping to get something like 400 people an hour through this.
Oh, wow.
So it's a time ticket. Whether they'll succeed, I mean, I think, you know, we're all sort of speculating on it. I think it will be very, very successful this summer as tourists come to Chicago, mm-hmm, looking for something to do. And you've got to remember something like 2.5 million people have seen Hamilton in Chicago. And because the theater here is much larger than the one on Broadway, there are more people in Chicago,
oh, interesting,
who've seen it than in New York.
How long does Hamilton stay on stage in Chicago?
I think it stays until not that long. That's a great question. And I am fairly confident in saying it will be gone this time next year.
You think so?
I'm pretty sure.
So, I mean, is this the mount you should see when a huge Broadway show, Hamilton is the biggest, but let's say Dear Evan Hansen. Yeah. Like, are they going to do like a year, 2-3 years in Chicago, or are we going to see what we see sort of with some of the shows that come through that are 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks?
Well, I think it depends on the producer. There's a couple of different schools of thought. So in the case of Hamilton, right, that was the first, we were the first city that it came after New York, and it has sold pretty much every seat in Chicago since it arrived here. The thing is with Hamilton, if you're the producer, is you're protecting in New York City a very expensive ticket. So in other words, if you want to see Hamilton tomorrow night, you got to open that Justin Kaufman wallet, mm-hmm, and just drop out all the cash.
Big money.
They don't really want you to be able to come to Chicago and see it for $80 on Gold Star. You know, they don't want... They don't want that.
I can't walk
they
out don't and be want like, that. I got a 2-for-1.
So they have to protect. So that's their dilemma. And I think the reality of our city, which we have lots and lots of visitors, but we're not, you know, we don't have the ability to sustain 20-year runs of shows like New York does.
Right.
And so I think that's what you're seeing. But really, you can't complain. It's been here like 3 years.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
It's been a major, major. And the money that it's made for waiters in the loop and the parking lots, and it's been a phenomenon. But I don't think they'll let it slow down. So I think you'll find in early 2020 that show exits.
Right. They're going to do the Better to Flame Out Than Fade Away.
Right. And the other reality is that every city in the world wants it. So therefore, if they go to another city, they can command those massive prices again. So they don't, it's this whole business of scarcity. You know, they don't want to have half, or even, frankly, they don't even want a 90% house. They want to always be a sought after ticket.
Okay. So Hamilton, of course, and Broadway in Chicago has really, truly become a juggernaut in the way that Broadway shows are trying out here.
You see
this with the Cher show and the Tootsie.
Yeah, we have three.
And, of course, Hamilton being the next destination after New York. What impact? I mean, is there going to be a point where a newspaper like yours or others have any sort of impact study on how it affects the rest of Chicago theater, how it affects the homegrown stuff, maybe the loop stuff, the Goodman, Steppenwolf, but then also the off loop, the at least the air that is being given to some of the other theaters in town.
So I've never really seen a satisfactory answer to that. There's two schools of thought. One is this, that shows like Hamilton function as kind of entry-level exposure. So little Johnny goes to Hamilton, gets into the theater, and then might go the next week to some off-loop musical, or persuade his parents to take him or something like that. That's one sort of argument mm-hmm. that you hear.
Sure.
That in other words, that if we didn't have big shows, then you know, there'd be no shows.
Right,
and also, they bring people specifically to town. So if you're coming to town to see Hamilton, you might go and see comedy at Second City the next night. No question about that. So that, and of course, you're going to eat in a restaurant, all the rest of it. So there's a huge economic value to that.
Unless you're me, and you just go to the 7-Eleven, get a Twix, sneak that in, and when it gets all melty.
That's right.
That's where you're going through, like, second or third act.
You spent all your money on the tickets. So there's that. Now, the other problem, the other theory, though, is that people only have so much money, and that shows like Hamilton suck up a lot of oxygen. Like, every theater in town was whining at me last week because I've written a lot of stories about Hamilton the exhibition, right? Talking to Lynn. Lynn comes in. We love Lynn. Every time you mention Lynn, everyone clicks on the story. So it feeds itself, and his promotional value and his ability to use social media is astonishingly brilliant. And every hour I'm working on that, I'm not promoting, obviously, some off-loop
sure,
theater.
Right, right.
So, you know, that's the game, and that's the sort of the marketplace. I think in general, though, it's a net gain for Chicago. I see it in some ways, this exhibition, as like the consolation prize for the Lucas Museum. You know, I was in favor of the Lucas Museum. I know it's a controversial thing to say, but I was. I think that the net benefit of it was mm-hmm. we would have had an international brand. It would have been, you know, I was talking to the mayor the other day, and he's like, it's a parking lot. It's still a parking lot. He's still annoyed. And I think, you know, that so we didn't do that. But we did. But Hamilton, of course, it's a temporary building, so it didn't get the same.
Yeah, I was wondering. I actually was thinking about that while you were talking about the hangar. I was like, wait a second, that's on parkland. But
it's a building on parkland. But the fact that they've agreed to take it down in a year, it just changes everything. I this is a unique Chicago thing that I never fully understand. Mm-hmm. But in this case, that's the theory. So you get some of the benefits of that, where there are people who will come to Chicago this summer to see that exhibition, or maybe they'll be like, oh, we could go to St. Louis, we could go to Chicago. Like, yeah, but they got that new Hamilton. And if you talk to tourism people in the city, they often say one of the problems. I have one of my very good friends, my best friends, is a concierge here at the Langham Hotel. My friend Chris Palm, and he always says, one of the problems in Chicago is not enough to do.
Mm.
And a lot of locals go, oh, what do you mean not enough to do?
Yeah, but, I just did. I bristled a little bit because hair up on my neck on that one.
But people think, oh, I've been to the Art Institute. Mm. I've been to the... So you have to generate new things for people.
Right.
New things. And we're not always... Chicago can be a little stick in the mud on that stuff, right? Here we've got this summer a new thing. And there'll be people who've got friends from out of town saying, hey, I'll come this summer and stay with you and sleep on your floor. So I can go to the Hamilton exhibition.
Well, I guess so. I you know, as a local in me, it just says, you know, from Wrigley Field to, like you said, the Art Institute, to so many things that are happening in this town. And to think about the competition, as somebody who just this summer was like, I'm going to do a road trip. We're going to do an art road trip. We're going to go to Cleveland. We're going to hit up Pittsburgh.
You're a big spender.
Right. But the point being that I'm like, that's a town. When you're in Cleveland, you're like, ah, okay, we did the one thing. I guess we can go see what that old park downtown. But you know what I mean? Like, I feel like Chicago doesn't have that problem.
No, I don't think it does. But I do think it's nice to have... It does sort of generate excitement. And I think the thing about this Hamilton exhibition that I will say is that you can't see it anywhere else.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So it's here first. You know, the reason it's not in New York, of course... Not that they're really saying this, but this is the truth. There's just nowhere to put it.
They couldn't build a high line, like whole thing.
That'd have been
stand an L line.
That'd have been like in Staten Island or the Bronx, and nobody would have gone. So they figured out, oh, Chicago, they got the lake. Oh, we can put it by the lake.
Make it temporary, no controversy. Right. Chris Jones is here. Okay, we'll take a break. Come back, and I want to wrap with this Hamlet
Oh, it's a great story.
What a great story. A Hamlet actual case in front of a judge, and real judge, and a prosecutor, a real prosecutor, the prosecutor in Kim Fox. An amazing art meets life and imitate all of it from the Chicago Humanities Festival last week. We'll talk about that. Chris Jones is here. Stay with us. Extension 720. Chris Jones is here, chief theater critic, Chicago Tribune. Extension 720. Thank you for coming in tonight, too, because we were booking this show at the last minute just because the White Sox game got rained out. We weren't supposed to be on. We weren't even supposed to be here tonight.
We're a better show than the White Sox.
And they won three in a row. Extension 720. We're batting about 500. Okay, so let's talk about the Chicago Humanities Festival. This season they've got right now, they're in the middle of their festival season.
Spring Festival.
Talking about power. They did something, and you reviewed it, and it just blew my mind, the concept, where they did a live, it's a fictional reenactment of the trial of Hamlet. Just this idea that they take the story a little bit further and talk about actually trying some of the characters in that play. And they actually got Judge Lefkow,
who's
a famous judge here in Chicago, Joan Lefkow, everyone knows. They got Kim Fox, the district attorney, to actually...
She's been in the news.
Yeah, but she played the prosecutor, and they did this for real. They got all these people to actually buy into it. What was this like? What was this?
It was a really... Well, the first thing to know is it's not funny. So nothing about this was funny. In fact, Judge Lefkow at one point says to the audience, and there were like 400 people there.
It was the MCA, right?
The MCA. She says, anyone who laughs, you know, you're kicked out. And I was thinking... Okay, I guess it's serious. So it's deadly serious. So that's the first thing you know. And the idea is Hamlet is on trial for the murder of Polonius. Now, if you've forgotten Hamlet,
yes,
but you know, you would know it if you're listening to this intelligent show. But if you've temporarily forgotten it, Hamlet goes into his mother's closet, Gertrude's closet, and stabs a character called Polonius behind the arras, which is an Elizabethan term for like closet, basically. He just goes, "What ho, a rat!" And he gets out his knife and he like stabs at the air and he kills poor Polonius. So the premise of the trial is that he's on trial for that act.
Wow.
Hamlet is living on the south side of Chicago in this reenactment, living in Daly Garden, sort of a public housing project on 34th and Carroll or something. And Gertrude, and they all live in the same apartment building. And a lot of the premise of the trial was really about how credible was it that there was a rat at this, in this closet. And Gertrude's like, well, I leave food in there. And there could have been a rat. And Hamlet has this traumatic relationship with Ophelia, who's his girlfriend. So Hamlet, Ophelia, and Gertrude are all played by actors. And then... essentially, the rest of the structure of this thing is this deadly serious trial, including a real medical examiner who shows up and says, okay, the stab wound goes from right to left or left to right or something.
Unbelievable.
And then the prosecution on the opening night was Kim Fox. So, you know, I was like, this is going to write itself. It's going to write itself. You know, all I have to do is say, you know, she didn't prosecute Jesse Smollett, but she prosecuted Hamlet. And so she was there. And then there was this defense attorney who was very, very good and got him off. And it was sort
of... What a story.
It was sort of hilarious because it was like, okay, in Cook County... you can't convict Hamlet. Like, and this guy, so the idea for this is originally a European idea. I think it comes from Geneva in Switzerland. And so they had this Swiss guy comes out. I'd like to tell you all the verdicts for Hamlet in all these other different cities we've done this in. And he's like, in Zurich, he goes to prison for 10 years. In Paris, he goes to prison for 12 years. And then I'm like, and in Cook County, it walks.
What a tremendous piece of art.
That was great fun. Only in Chicago. Yeah. It was a really great
time. I mean, kudos to the Chicago Humanities Festival to get the real Judge Joan Lefkow, to get the real Kim Fox to play along in this scenario.
Totally.
And especially for Kim Fox, who probably agreed to this before all the controversy.
Oh, there's no question about that.
but an amazing... There's things about the world we live in that... as everything gets serious and we get outraged about the outrage and everything that's happening and social media and everywhere, that you have these creative opportunities.
Yeah.
And this is one of them where it grabs your attention. And you're like, what a great moment to be a part of, to watch, to be there, to watch Life Imitates Art, the whole thing, to be in that audience.
It was the coolest thing. It was absolutely the coolest thing. You know, one of the funny things, too, is that most lawyers are actors, really. You know, they're all hams, and there's nothing a good lawyer likes than a show. So I'm at the, you know, so at the end of all of this, so we go through this trial, and then they go, then the Swiss guy comes out and goes, we know, is your body's open? We will consider as a verdict. And they pick 12 people at random, and I of course, head directly to the bar, awaiting the verdict. And it's filled with lawyers, and all they can talk about is the show and how great their colleagues did. And they were having different lawyers, and it was sort of hilarious. And I was just thought, wow. And you know, yeah. And the legal community, of course, as you know, is a completely different world and a big one. And they all know each other and they all compete with each other. It's sort of like it's a parallel to the arts community in some ways. And it was a real blast of a night.
That's great. All right, Chris, as we wrap up here, we got a couple minutes. Shows you're looking forward to. Usually, you and I have talked for years, but it used to be summer was downtime for theater. It's not like that anymore.
No, it's a big weekend. We've got like just this week. Let me see what I'm doing. I'm going Friday night. The Paramount Theater in Aurora is doing actually a pre-Broadway show called August Rush. Do you remember that movie?
Oh, yeah.
2007. Robin Williams, I think, was in it. It's about this kid who's a musical prodigy who leaves this orphanage and goes to look for his parents. That's being turned into a Broadway show, and they're trying it out in, believe it or not, Aurora. So I'm going to schlep out there on the, you know, BNSFF train, I hope, on Friday night. On Saturday, we've got Lyric Opera is doing West Side Story.
Right, they've been traditionally doing things in the spring that are a little bit more popular, less opera, right?
Exactly. Thursday night, you've got Matilda out at the Drury Lane Oak Book, or as we critics called it, the Dreary Lane. Just kidding. That's on Thursday night. So you know, it's kind of a packed. Experience.
My last moment just is with the. I saw today in the Black Club Chicago the tearing down of the old Heartland Cafe, and behind the Heartland Cafe is a Heartland Studio, I'd done shows there, and I know that you've reviewed shows in there, but it kind of is as hard it was for Rogers Park to watch that building go down. It does. Point out that smaller, really small black box theaters are going the way of the Dodo. I mean, you don't see them as much anymore here in Chicago.
No, I mean, a lot of them are turning into condos. The one bright spot, the one silver lining to that story is that we're seeing now that condo developers, in order to get their big building approved, are saying to like aldermen to neighborhoods, hey, we'll bring in a Schadenfreude, we'll bring in an arts company that can be in the building.
That's interesting.
So you've seen that in a couple of places. So you've got, you know, sometimes that's true, but man, that old Heartland Studio, and in the summer, I don't believe there was any air conditioning in there to speak
there
of.
There wasn't. I remember like, we had to go to a Home Depot and get one. I remember that. It was like that one broke and we had to go get one and everyone had to borrow a truck. The whole place.
That's Chicago, man.
It really was. And it's a bummer to see that. All in ruin up on Rogers Park. Chris Jones, of course, the chief theater critic over at the Chicago Tribune, also the author of Rise Up, Broadway and American Society from Angels in America to Hamilton. Great to see you.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks,
Jason,
for spending some time.
My pleasure.
And we'll look forward to your writing.
See you next time.
Well, that's going to do it tonight for Extension 720, special rain delay version. Coming up next, Mel Allen. We'll have the story of Freddie Lynn. No, that's Patty Vasquez is coming up next. We'll be back. Ah, man, geez, we got a couple of hours next week. Like, I think on Tuesday and Wednesday, we're in for an hour after an early. They're going east, the White Sox. And then I think the next Extension 720 we're working on will be next week, Thursday. So that's coming up.